From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, intrepid misadventurer Tim Cahill tells us about the proper footwear for walking across the Death Valley Desert and how to behave when you're surrounded by man-eating sharks. His latest book, A Wolverine is Eating My Leg, is his second collection of humorous, self-deprecating tales of travel in the wilderness. Also today, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Galway Kinnell reads from his new poem, When One Has Lived a Long Time Alone, and he discusses the period of isolation that led to the poem. Also, jazz critic Evan Whitehead reviews a new documentary on the late pianist and composer Thelonious Monk. And book critic John Leonard reviews Mary Gordon's new novel, The Other Side. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The flow of more East German refugees to the West over the past 3 days has prompted another protest by East German authorities. They're challenging the West German account of what happened and are demanding the expulsion of East Germans who have gathered at the embassies in Prague and Warsaw. The BBC's Ben Bradshaw reports from Berlin.
The government in East Berlin has accused Bonn of breaking its word by continuing to let East Germans into its embassy buildings in Warsaw and Prague. A message from East Germany's permanent representative in Bonn to the West German minister responsible charges West Germany with a blatant abuse of trust and demands the immediate expulsion of the East Germans and their return to East Germany. There, the statement goes on, they can pursue their desire to leave the country legally. The representative also attacks the way West Germany has presented recent events. He says there was no bowing to pressure from Bonn or from anyone else. The decision to allow those occupying the embassies out to the West was taken by East Germany and East Germany alone. It was taken solely on humanitarian grounds, not least in the interests of the small children involved.
The BBC's Ben Bradshaw. The Soviet government, warning that urgent measures are needed to prevent nationwide economic collapse, has called for a 15-month ban on labor strikes. It was one of several emergency measures proposed today to halt the Soviet economic decline, NPR's Ann Cooper reports.
Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev told members of the national legislature that a strike ban is essential to save his beleaguered program of economic and social change. Strikes that swept through coal mining regions this summer have depleted fuel supplies, and walkouts over ethnic disputes have damaged local economies in several parts of the country. The government also asked the legislature to approve use of troops to end a rail blockade that's cut off food and fuel supplies into the Southern Republic of Armenia. The blockade began several weeks ago as tensions increased in a territorial fight between Armenia and the neighboring Republic of Azerbaijan. The legislature is expected to vote on the emergency measures tomorrow. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
New Zealand today called the dangers of pollution potentially as devastating as nuclear war. And in an address to the UN General Assembly, Prime Minister Geoffrey Palmer said the UN should create a body with binding powers to protect the environment. Palmer said the conferences on the subject often turn to debating societies that allow politicians to give simplistic and politically safe comments. Palmer also urged the world body to outlaw completely drift net fishing, huge nets used by trawlers that scoop up all living animals in the sea, turtles, whales, dolphins, birds, as well as fish. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 21 points to close at 2713. This is NPR News. The killing of a leading Greek politician is causing increasing bitterness between the ruling party and the Socialist Party of former Prime Minister Andreas Papandreou. The November 17th terrorist group has claimed responsibility for the killing, and conservatives say there are links between the terrorist group and the socialists. Malcolm Brabant has details.
The Greek government has stepped up its anti-terrorist drive following last Tuesday's murder of Paul Bakayanis. He was a spokesman for the conservative-style New Democracy Party and son-in-law of its leader, Konstantin Mitsotakis. Pro-government newspapers have been suggesting that the PASOK Socialist Party of Mr. Papandreou is behind November 17, but Mr. Papandreou has condemned those reports as lies. Last week, New Democracy accused the previous PASOK government of rejecting offers of help from America's CIA to smash November 17. But the New Democracy-led government is leaving no door closed in its hunt for Mr. Bakayanis' killers. And, according to police sources, American anti-terrorist experts will be arriving in Athens in the next few days to cooperate with their Greek colleagues. For National Public Radio, this is Malcolm Brabant in Athens.
A Republican lobbyist with former ties to the White House told Congress today that he played by the rules in obtaining lucrative federal housing subsidies. But the head of a House panel charged he had reaped benefits of a greased sweetheart deal. Former George Bush and Ronald Reagan campaign advisor Paul Manafort, who 3 months ago acknowledged to the same panel that his work amounted to influence peddling, denied being given an advance tip by insiders at HUD about the availability of federal subsidies. A Massachusetts defense contractor was charged in Boston federal court today with illegally discharging toxic waste and knowingly endangering the safety of his employees. Burlington-based Borjon Chemical Technology and its president, John Borowski, were charged with violating the U.S. Clean Water Act. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Action and adventure without the gratuitous chest-pounding. That's how Tim Cahill describes his writing. Most of his articles are self-deprecating accounts of his death-defying experiences around the world in caves, mountains, deserts, rapids, and the deep sea. Cahill is a contributing editor to Rolling Stone magazine and a columnist for Outside. His articles have been published in two collections, A Wolverine is Eating My Leg and Jaguars Ripped My Flesh. These were the in-house generic titles his editors at Outside magazine gave his pieces.
A long time ago, about 1976 or so, four of us were charged with the responsibility of coming up with a concept for a magazine that ultimately became Outside magazine. In talking about the various kinds of stories that we might have in it, I had suggested that it might be a good idea to have a travel adventure story. The other editors disagreed because at that time, travel adventure was the sole province of magazines that might be entitled Adventure for Man or Man's Challenge, Man's Testicle, something like that. And you know the ones. They have an illustration of a woman in an artfully torn blouse. Some guy,
right?
Some guy that needs a shave, and he's you know, he's pulling it through. There's rhinos there, and all the stories in those magazines were entitled "Jaguars Rip My Flesh," or some of them were happening right in the present tense, even as you read them. A wolverine is eating my leg. My thought was that you could actually write a literate outdoor adventure story, and that there was a whole strain in American literature that goes from James Fenimore Cooper through Moby Dick. Huckleberry Finn is an outdoor adventure. Ernest Hemingway, and that strain in American literature was not being well served by the stories in Action for Man. I suggested perhaps we put people out whose first impulse was not to, if they saw a shark, pull out a penknife and do a death battle with it, but maybe examine the terror and some of the wonder at the core of that experience. And anyway, the other editors disagreed with me, and so the stories that I wrote early on were always being poked fun at.
Now, some of the novelists who you referred to, who wrote in the adventure style, didn't have to actually have those adventures themselves. They could sit home and imagine them, whereas you actually have to go on these adventures and risk your neck to bring home the story. In the introduction to your book, you say that the next time interviewers ask you why you take so many risks, you're going to tell them that you think risk is a form of therapy. So I think I would be remiss if I didn't ask you to explain that.
I think it is. I wrote a book a few years back. It took me called Buried Dreams, and it was an intense look at the psychological maneuverings of a serial killer named John Wayne Gacy, who was convicted of murdering more people than anyone else in American history. After 100 hours of interviews and 3.5 years of working on the thing, I found myself obsessed with the human evil. I found the idea of one more morbid detail was going to send me screaming around the bend, and when I felt myself reach that point, I thought, why don't I go out and risk my life for no very good reason? And I'll tell you what happens. It's true. If you are obsessed with the problem of human evil and you find yourself sleeping badly, looking at people on the street and saying, that's a potential victim, very, very unhealthy ways to think, and you arrange to go diving with sharks in 2 weeks. As 1 week passes, you begin thinking a little bit more about the sharks and a little bit less about the human evil. The day before you get in the water with those sharks, I guarantee you, you are not going to think about anything but sharks. And while you're in the water, there is no thinking, no thinking in the usual sense. You have to act deftly. The sharks are all around you, 360 degrees. You must be very aware and very conscious. And then when you get out of the water, you find that that focus, that intense focus that you've had on those sharks and on acting deftly has resolved itself into a kind of a euphoria that is a very intense relaxation. I think that you can literally put your life on the line in order to save your soul.
Mm-hmm. Well, I see what you're saying, although it's not the therapy I would would choose for myself, but
it's not
what you're saying I comprehend.
But not everyone needs to do this kind of therapy. What I'm talking about is very akin to Oriental meditation techniques. Some people can do this, sitting cross-legged in a room on a pillow. Others of us need a little harder bump.
Right. My guest is Tim Cahill. He's an adventure travel writer. He writes for Outside Magazine, and he has a new collection of articles called A Wolverine Is Eating My Leg. Now, one of your last big trips, and you're writing a book about this now, was to travel from the southern tip of South America, Tierra del Fuego, to the northern tip of North America, Prudhoe Bay. And you made the Guinness Book of Records. You made the trip in 24 days. The previous record was 56 days. This is a trip of 15,000 miles. And you went with someone who'd already broken long-distance travel records three times before. Why did you want to make this trip?
It's the same... the same impulse that drives people to say, well, I'd like to drive Interstate 80 across the United States, get a feeling for it. I wanted to see, I'd been to various places in South America and, of course, North America, and I knew those places very well. And what I wanted was what they would call in the movies an establishing shot. I wanted to see all of the Americas in a month. And get a sense for what all the Americas were. I would call this a high-speed travelogue.
What kind of vehicle did you travel in?
It was a GMC Sierra pickup truck, I don't have any advertising relationship with GMC, and so I'm sad to say that the truck performed flawlessly.
What are the tricks to long-distance driving at as high a speed as possible? There was you and another driver. What was your technique for alternating?
It was the coffee technique. it got down to where each person could only drive about 6 hours and then would have to sleep. And when you felt yourself winding down, you woke up the other person, who would get up, make himself a cup of coffee, and about 20 minutes would go by, and then you would feel like driving, and you could drive for 6 hours or so. I must say, though, that that was the only drug that we used at all, caffeine, mm-hmm. on the entire trip. But it's an amazingly, especially the South American varieties of coffee that you can get, it's an amazingly potent drug, and occasionally... my partner Gary Sorby and myself would have coffee parties. Yeah, I think that happened twice or three times on this trip. Yeah, we would both drink coffee together, and since we'd been together in the same truck and gone through, oh Lord knows how many stops with very young soldiers with automatic weapons, and you have to convince them that you are actually out here on a mission of Pan-American unity, having a lot of fun, and that they should just let you go. All this stuff was happening while one person was sleeping or one person was awake. And so occasionally we'd have a coffee party and catch up on catch up on the latest death-defying news from the other fellow.
Well, speaking of death-defying news, I'm sure when you were traveling through South America, you had to make a lot of detours to avoid small wars and battles that were going on. And I wonder how it felt when you were making a narrow detour around a war zone, thinking, well, they're having a war, but I'm breaking the Guinness Book of Records. Did you feel that the trip was a little trivial or pointless in the light of the war going on a mile away?
Yeah, I mean, that's an absolute fact. Here we were on a lark, and people's lives were at stake. But I'll tell you, when we went to this thing needs to be set up ahead of time, because the stopwatch starts when you're in the tip of South America and it ends when you're in Prudhoe Bay. You can't say, I got caught 5 days at the border at Nicaragua trying to convince them to. So you go to Nicaragua first to set it up. And when we went into the tourist bureau, it took about 3 days to crack this. And what we said is, we're going to drive through all of the Americas. And we would like your cooperation here in Nicaragua to show that it's possible and to show some semblance of Pan-American unity. And do you know what? They became very, very enthusiastic about the idea. They liked the idea.
So you're saying it didn't seem trivial to them?
It didn't seem trivial to them. No, it seemed to be an expression of Pan-American unity, just as we had said.
Well, I have to ask you about your experiences in Death Valley, and this goes back a few years, and there's an article about this in your new book, A Wolverine is Eating My Leg. And you went to, what was your goal here in going to Death Valley? You were going from the lowest point to the highest point in the continent, was that it?
Yeah, some people understand that instinctively. I noticed, looking at the map, that in the continental United States, the lowest point is Death Valley, 282 feet below sea level. The highest point is Mount Whitney, about 15,000 feet, a little under. And these places are separated by about 100 miles. Why not walk between them? Some people understand that, some people don't. I thought, well, I'll write an article, and I'll call it Going to Extremes, and I'll try to explain why some people understand it and some people don't. But I ran into some problems because there were some things I didn't understand about the desert.
Like what?
Well,
the problems were that you nearly died in the desert. But we'll get to that a little bit later. What didn't you understand?
I nearly died in the desert because I didn't understand the desert and I hadn't prepared properly. I didn't understand that it's surrounded, Death Valley is surrounded by mountains. It's a big basin. It wants to be a lake. The sun won't let it be a lake. But when you get to the lowest point and you're walking there, there's just a thin salt crust, and the lake that wants to be there is lurking underneath in the form of hot mud. So it's like walking on crusty snow. You know, it almost holds your weight, and then you crash through. You go up to your knee or up to your thigh in this hot mud. This was extremely uncomfortable and made me feel like a nincompoop anyway, because, I was out there. Secondly, it's not the heat that kills you in the desert. It's not that it gets to be 115 or 120 degrees. It's the ground itself. The Indian word for Death Valley means ground on fire, and the ground itself has been measured at about 200 degrees Fahrenheit, which means that if you fall down, you bake. And the very serious mistake I made was cracking through that mud, that salt crust in the mud, building myself a shelter from the sun. I walked at night and slept during the day, and left the wet, muddy boots on the ground on fire, which means they were baked into strange, cruel, unfoot-like shapes. And I had another 100 miles to go.
And your feet were pretty out of shape themselves by that point.
Yeah, the word tenderfoot occurred to me quite often.
Well, I hate to leave you stranded in the middle of the desert like this, but we have to take a short break, and we'll find out what your fate was when we return. Obviously, you lived to tell the story. My guest is Tim Cahill, and he's an action-adventure writer, among other things, and he writes for Outside Magazine, and he has a new collection of articles called A Wolverine Is Eating My Leg. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Okay, Tim Cahill, we left you with shoes that were baked out of shape while your feet were completely swollen out of shape in the middle of Death Valley. How did you ever walk the remaining mileage?
Well, remember back those strange little things on the sides of Buicks. They call them porta vents or something, little holes in the sides of Buicks. I made those in my shoes. I just took a knife and cut my shoes up and continued walking, and strangely enough, the human body is willing to accommodate itself to just about anything. I got so that I walked during the day. This whole trip took about 10 days, during which time I thought about taking things to various extremes and the worth of it, or the non-worth of it. I think we all start as travel adventurers. I mean, have you ever seen a toddler? Of course everybody has. Try to climb the sofa. The child falls down, cries, and a little while later gets up and does it again. Some of us learn our lessons, and we become postmen or buyers for Bloomingdale's or what have you. And others of us, myself included, just simply don't learn our lessons, and we keep climbing the sofa and falling down.
You know what I really related to in your story about Death Valley? You said that during the day, in the middle of the heat and sun, you'd say to yourself, I know I'd just be so happy if only I had some shade and something to drink. But then at night, when you'd have some shade and something to drink, there was so much more you yearned for that you still felt completely unsatisfied.
I think that's why people on spiritual quests go to the desert, because it jerks you around in your material wants so much.
Mm-hmm.
With the sun directly overhead, it's ugly. It's ugly. And as twilight deepens, it becomes absolutely beautiful. And what happens with there's a cycle of wants and needs. And with the sun directly overhead, all you want is shade and water. But as the world becomes beautiful, it expands around you and it shimmers around you in this wonderful deepening purple sensation. You want everything, and it truly gives you something to think about. And that's why I think that through the centuries, spiritual people have gone to the desert.
Well, you know, when you get back from the desert or from the rapids in the Himalayas or from some other natural extreme that you've taken yourself to, and you're home again in the comforts of home, how long does the exhilaration of the adventure last?
I think it lasts all your life. I've been talking about some of these adventures lately, and feel that every time I talk about them, I can feel them again. They're like photographs of friends or families that I can go through, these little stories that I feel in my heart and in my mind and see with a visual eye.
Do you have another adventure in the works?
Not really.
You're settling down?
Yeah, I'm considering. I have one more book in which an animal will attack me. A jaguar's rip my flesh, or a wolverine is eating my legs. Sparrows might peck my spleen. I don't know. One more, and then I think I'm retired from the adventure travel game.
Okay, how come?
I have a sense that my luck is running out.
Gee, what makes you think that? I mean, that's a really something you really have to take seriously.
I do. I never worried about things before. I knew I would come through. I knew I would survive. I knew I would overcome the obstacles. And occasionally, these days, I'm beset by doubts. Do you remember Richard Halliburton?
No, I don't.
Richard Halliburton was a adventure travel writer of the late 20s and early 30s. He was, he was in all the newspapers. Daring Dick, they called him. He swam the Hellespont. He was the guy that when they built the Panama Canal, he swam the Panama Canal, and they said he paid for his own tonnage, just as a ship would, 36 cents. Wonderful publicity stunts and things like that. At the age of 39, Richard Halliburton decided that he was going to sail a Chinese junk all the way from Hong Kong to San Francisco for the San Francisco International Fair. And he vanished in a typhoon. And reading biographies of Halliburton, he seemed to realize that his luck was running out. And he really should not have done this one last thing. I don't know how to say it any more clearly than it's a feeling that you have. And my feeling is that I've pushed it just about as far as I want to do it.
So does that mean one last adventure, a few more, or no more?
A few more.
Mm-hmm.
A few more. I I'm a sucker for them. I want to go out. I want to go out and do it. I want to travel. But the essential fact of my life is that I'm a writer. A lot of I speak at colleges quite a bit, and a lot of college students come up and say, "Well, how do I finance a life of travel and adventure?" And I have to tell them that the true fact of the matter is that it's not travel and adventure. That's not the reason people read me. It's because I'm a writer and because I enjoy writing. So that if I was confined to my home today, I would have enough material to write for the rest of my life, and I could find it. I could find it right inside of my home.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, good luck on your future trips, the few that you plan still on taking, and I thank you very much for sharing some of your experiences with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Tim Cahill's books include A Wolverine is Eating My Leg and Jaguars Ripped My Flesh. You can read his articles in Outside Magazine and Rolling Stone. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, writer Russell Banks. His new novel, Affliction, deals with domestic violence, a subject drawn from Banks' own life. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead takes a look at Straight No Chaser, the new documentary on the late pianist and composer Thelonious Monk. It features performances that were never released on record and interviews with Monk's friends, family, and fellow musicians. Also, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Galway Kinnell has a new poem about isolation and alienation. Kinnell reads from his poem When One Has Lived a Long Time Alone and talks with us about the experiences that led to it. And book critic John Leonard reviews Mary Gordon's new novel. It chronicles four generations of an Irish family living in Queens, New York. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Once again, the nation's highest court has convened, as it does every year on the first Monday in October. NPR's Nina Totenberg has more on the story.
On the docket this term are three abortion cases. There's also a so-called right to die case, testing whether a state can intervene in the medical care of a comatose patient with no hope of recovery to keep the patient alive against the wishes of close relatives. The abortion and right to die cases are scheduled for oral argument in December, but today anti-abortion activists got a major boost when Justice John Paul Stevens announced he has disqualified himself from the major abortion case for undisclosed reasons. Stevens is a supporter of the court's 1973 Roe v. Wade decision, the decision that in effect legalized abortion. His recusal from this year's major abortion case means that of the eight justices who will hear the case, only three are clear Roe supporters. Four would reverse Roe, and one, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, is uncommitted but critical of Roe. So the best abortion rights activists can hope for now is a tie vote. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
Less than 2 days after an exodus to the west from Prague by 5,000 East Germans, some 3,000 of their countrymen have taken refuge in the West German embassy in that city. Witnesses said that police tried to pull away masses of people who tried to climb over the embassy's back fence. But then the officers moved aside when the West German ambassador appeared in the garden and said, let them go. There's new hope for people with colon cancer. Today, the National Cancer Institute announced that a combination drug treatment can extend the lives of many people whose cancer is discovered late. NPR's Michael Skolda reports.
Colon cancer is fairly common and usually deadly once it has started spreading. The new drug treatment can't fight the most advanced colon cancer that has spread to other organs, but it can help people whose cancer has spread to the lymph nodes around the colon, a condition known as Duke's C colon cancer. Until now, the only treatment was to remove the lymph nodes and tumors, and half of the patients still died within 5 years. The new drug therapy, which begins after surgery, can keep many people alive beyond that. It combines a common cancer drug with a drug called levamisole, which is mainly used to fight intestinal worms in animals. Researchers don't know why the combination works so well, but they say it's the first big step forward in treating colon cancer, and the National Cancer Institute is making the experimental treatment widely available through doctors. This is Michael Skolar in Washington.
In large part because of government construction, building construction spending in August had its biggest advance this year. Officials say the gain was in non-residential and government building. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up almost 21 points to close at 2,713.72. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. There's a new documentary about the great jazz pianist and composer Thelonious Monk. It's called Straight No Chaser. Monk died in 1982 at the age of 64. When he came to prominence in the 1940s, he was regarded as a founder of the bebop movement. But his music transcended genres. It reached back to the stride piano of the 20s and anticipated the dissonant free jazz of the 50s and 60s. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of Straight No Chaser. He says the documentary will be a good revelation to Monk fans, and it's also good comedy.
Charlotte Zwerin's new documentary about Thelonious Monk is pretty terrific. I have a couple of quibbles with it, but they don't amount to much. The reason it's terrific is there's so much of Monk himself in it. On the bandstand, backstage, on the road, on the street, and in the recording studio. Monk is one of the more misunderstood jazz masters, a personal eccentric with a piano style to match. His approach was so different from the norm, some folks thought he couldn't really play at all. Monk could play the piano. It's just that he played by his own rules and fashioned a technique to his own specific needs. When you see his hands at the keyboard, and there are lots of opportunities to do that in this movie, you realize that Monk wasn't just splanking around. He obviously chose his notes with great care, sizing up the keyboard visually before striking a chord or hammering out a line. To make things difficult for himself at the keyboard. He'd wear a large loose ring on the small finger of his right hand, so he'd have to keep pushing it back into place in the course of a solo. In one scene in the movie, he fishes a handkerchief out of his pocket so he can wipe his face and passes it back and forth from one hand to the other while he's playing. Because of his odd ways and odd name, Thelonious Monk was sort of a joke in the culture at large. In 1964, Time magazine wrote him up as a zany kook, and his name alone was a running gag on the old Dobie Gillis TV show. In the movie, you get a sense of how he was regarded, from the jivey way record producer Tio Macero deals with him at a recording session, and from this interview with a German TV reporter.
Mr. Monk, you always wear different hats and caps in your concerts. Do they have an influence in your music?
No.
That's a good question.
Maybe they do, I don't know.
And do you think that the piano has enough keys, 88, or do you want more or less?
It's hard work to play those 88s.
That episode happened on a European tour on which Monk led an octet that played scaled-down versions of charts written for his big band. We see and hear that octet on stage and in rehearsal. That band never went into the studio, by the way, so the movie and the soundtrack album contain some newly released Monk music. Most of Thelonious Monk's Straight No Chaser was shot by documentarist Christian Blackwood in New York and Europe in 1967 and 8 for a one-hour German TV special that was shown just once. Most of it has never been seen before, and all of it is new to American audiences. Director Charlotte Zwerin has augmented that footage with new interviews with Monk's son and a few associates, but it's Thelonious himself who dominates. There are also a few minutes of voiceover narration that don't really explain Monk's position in the music, and pianists Barry Harris and Tommy Flanagan play a couple of duets on Monk tunes that don't especially illuminate his composing. Those are the minor quibbles I mentioned. Monk could be a difficult and withdrawn man, and Straight No Chaser acknowledges that side of him, but it's also the funniest movie about a jazz musician ever made. Monk's playful nature came out in his music and in his personality, and Zwerin captures both. Warner Brothers picked up distribution of this film at the behest of Clint Eastwood, jazz's guardian angel in Hollywood. I'm told that Warner's expects to make its money back when it's released on video. They probably will. Straight No Chaser is rich enough to stand up on repeated viewings. Hardcore Monk fans, me included, will have to have a copy.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. Thelonious Monk, Straight No Chaser, is now playing in New York. It opens later this month in San Francisco, Boston, and Denver.
Once you play it the first time, that's where the feeling and everything is. And after that, it starts going downhill.
This is Fresh Air. Galway Kinnell won the 1983 Pulitzer Prize for his book Selected Poems. After reading the collection, critic and poet Robert Haas wrote, "It's increasingly clear that Kinnell's ambition all along has been to hold death up to life as if he had it by the scruff of the neck, and to keep it there until he enacted a blessing from it." Kinnell published his first book of poems in 1960. Since 1981, Kinnell has taught at New York University. He also directs NYU's creative writing program. We invited him to the studio to talk about his work and to read a stanza from his new poem, When One Has Lived a Long Time Alone. The poem is published in this month's Atlantic Magazine.
When one has lived a long time alone, one likes alike the pig, who brooks no deferment of gratification, and the porcupine or thorned pig, who enters the cellar, but not the house itself, due to eating down the cellar stairs on the way up. And one likes the worm, who by bunching herself together and expanding rubs her way through the ground, no less than the butterfly, who totters full of worry among the daylilies as they darken. And more, one finds one likes any other species better than one's own, which has gone amuck, making one self-estranged when one has lived a long time alone.
This is a poem about living in exile from people, in a way, and, and having this temporary bond with insects and animals, and
yeah, kind of
instead of people.
It's living alone, and it's living kind of bitterly alone in a way, and so it could be characterized as depression. However, depression usually doesn't have that lively interest in other beings.
Yeah.
You know, depression generally closes off interest in everything. So it isn't really depression. It's more misanthropy, really. But it's got something, it's connected to depression.
Is this a period you feel like you're in now?
No. That is behind me. The period ended the moment I put the last touch, the finishing touch on the poem.
So you started,
There's no connection between finishing the poem and the termination of that period. But it just did happen that for a year and a half I lived in rather severe isolation.
Can I ask what brought you back from that, quote, exile?
Well, in part it was discussions with a very wise doctor that I'd been seeing. In part it was escaping from the clutches of psychopharmacologists. In part it was deciding to rejoin the species. And in part it was falling in love. And finally, it was climbing a mountain. This was in northern Italy. Along the path, there were little tableaus showing the life of Jesus. And it begins, the first tableau. It's a path that leads up to a church quite high along on a cliff. And the first tableau at the bottom shows Jesus being born and crying or calling out or whatever. You could see his mouth is open. And, of course, there are animals in the barn where he's born. And they all must be making a kind of wonderful, harmonious music together and loving. People are hovering over this child. So the child is born in complete kinship and in oneness with all the other species, the way our species was born and the way each of us individually is born. And then the tableaus show the gradual isolation of this man. But the thing about those later tableaus was that this was extremely beautiful place where I was, extremely beautiful. So the thing about those later tableaus was that these depictions of heaven with their all the gold and the angels singing and everything, it looked awfully tawdry compared with that this world where I was actually standing, you know, and as I turned to from the tableaus and looked at our world. And so how extraordinarily beautiful it is. Then something happened to me, and some kind of peace and fearlessness came into me, which haven't left me. So those are some of the things, I think, that have roused me from this misanthropic isolation. And I cannot believe that I will ever fall back into it again. I just can't think that would happen. Don't call me up, though.
And check.
And check.
You strike me as someone who, consciously or unconsciously, allows himself to experience emotional extremes. And
I think it's in that.
And then end up writing about it in some way.
It seems to be in the nature of the art, really. I don't think that I'm, a very clear example of this myself, but I feel it in myself too, and it's something like that, of exposing oneself to, allowing oneself to carry an emotional state to pretty far.
I want to quote something that Donald Hall, the writer, once said in talking about your work and in talking about what your work was not. He said, "There's a lot of poetry that is too damn life-affirming." Not seriously life-affirming, just affirmative, like the boosters in Reader's Digest. And this was an example of what your poems were not.
Oh, good.
he says, but Cannell knows we live by emptying ourselves. I don't know what he means by that myself, but but I was wondering if you would agree with Donald Hall there that too much poetry is consciously life-affirming and superficial in its own way.
I don't know if poetry.
Let me put it this way: let me ask you if you share his distrust of life-affirming poems.
I would, discovering a life-affirming poem, I would want to know through the poem if there's some area of some crucial area of experience had been left out, some. Troubling area of experience had been glossed over, and that I would want to know if it was at the price of ignorance that peace was achieved, and in which case it wouldn't be interesting.
This might sound like an off-the-wall question to you, but we've been talking mostly about isolation, alienation, things like that. A friend of a friend was saying that when they used to see your readings. Yeah, this is years ago they were referring to, that after the reading there would always be like swarms of young women coming up to the podium to try to meet you, poetry groupies, as she called them.
That's mostly a myth.
Is it?
But in any case, even to the degree that it is not a myth. The kind of special attention you get when you're on a stage, you know, especially when you're reading poetry, which touches people in their hearts, you know, and causes them to come up to you afterwards more openly.
Yeah.
Well, that that kind of renders all the more sharp the contrast between the life of on the stage and normal life afterwards. So, so there might have been. Of course, everybody who gives readings publicly, you know, knows there are these bright moments when everyone loves you and makes right. a lot of you, but it doesn't mean anything really. Afterwards, you go back to your normal life. And poems are not written on stages. Poems are written in dingy attics, and there's no way around it.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your poems. Thank you.
A pleasure.
Poet Galway Kinnell. Thelonious Monk playing Remember on Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
There was another large exodus of East Germans to the West over the weekend, and we're covering that, Terry. In science news, we have a potential cure for colon cancer, some new research on colon cancer that we'll be covering here in Washington. This is the first Monday in October, so the first session of the Supreme Court term will look ahead at what that term will bring. The Congress is discussing taxes, individual retirement accounts, and capital gains taxes, and we'll have a report. And we have a book that discusses forests, but it's really a book about history, a theory of history, that civilizations that preserve their forests are themselves preserved. And civilizations which don't die out.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Mary Gordon's books include the novels Final Payments, The Company of Women, Men and Angels, and a collection of stories called Temporary Shelter. Gordon has a new novel called The Other Side. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
Mary Gordon's novels of the American Irish have all been about parents and children, class and gender, dependence and autonomy, religion and neurosis, greed and sacrifice. Her irony is modern. Her knowingness is 19th century, omniscient and almost, but not quite, disdainful. Her latest, The Other Side, is no exception. It's hard to think of a more accomplished novel in recent American fiction. It's also hard to imagine a sadder one. On a single day in August in 1985, in a house on Linden Street in Queens, New York, we meet four generations of McNamaras. We wear their skins and read their minds. Each is an hour on the family clock, fixed in place, absorbed in his or her minutes, going nowhere. The second hand ticks by, lingers, points, sweeps on, returns. This is the all-knowing novelist. Like Ellen, the grandmother, mad and dying. Like her daughter Teresa, soured by the church. Like her granddaughter Camilla, angry and sexually entranced. The novelist tells stories with a taste for condemnation like a taste for salt, in a prose that lashes like a whip, that cracks and stings. Stories of rage, dread, envy, impotence, bitter disappointment, incomprehension, and contempt. Why are the McNamaras, except for a single great-granddaughter, so unhappy? Maybe some of it's Ireland's fault. Anger drove Ellen from Ireland at the turn of the century. Scorn made her feel real to herself. Contempt assured her she drew breath. Ellen's grandson, Dan, studied primitive societies in college and loved in them what he had loved about his grandparents, the sense of keeping the thread you were born holding between your fingers, of not letting go. And yet he thinks that unhappiness was bred into the bone, a message in the blood, a code of weakness, the sickle cell anemia of the Irish. They had to thwart joy in their lives. Camilla tells her Jewish lover, God, it must be a burden being part of a superior culture. It's kind of a relief coming from a bunch of third-raters or self-destructors, flops. A nun tells Camilla, you're just like all the Irish. You like the idea of a thing better than the thing itself. You like standing for something better than being something. Certainly, on the other side, in America, they have experienced religious bigotry and class hatred. And there's always their own church, the tyranny of superstition, against which various McNamaras revolt in the radical politics of union organizing, civil rights, social work, pro bono law. But finally, family itself, a death in life of grudge-holding, of absent love, of grim secrets, closes on their hopes like a fist. Ellen's 88-year-old husband Vincent, who is to return to his dying wife on this August day, thinks families are terrible. Why they weren't what they were meant to be, what they could almost be so easily. He shuffles memory like a deck of cards. They could all say, now we will love each other, and our unhappiness will end. He is Ulysses, but a warrior returned from a nursing home to a Penelope gone mad, and his war was a marriage. The only generosity in this astonishing novel is not forgiveness. It is the generosity of understanding, of getting it right, of making us see ourselves and cringe. I'm Irish, and I know myself better now, and I'm not happy about it, not at all.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Other Side by Mary Gordon. We want to say hello to our new listeners in Georgia on the Peach State Public Radio Network. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our director this week is Audrey Verblaitis. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with novelist Russell Banks. His new novel, Affliction, explores domestic male violence. It's something he's experienced firsthand. Also, rock historian Ed Ward looks back on some obscure original recordings of now classic songs. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.